Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. Corrie Mapp is a remarkable man. His life, a story of ambition, achievement, and quiet determination secured against Herculean odds. Born in Bridgetown, Barbados, he wanted to join the British Army at the age of six when he saw the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace. He enlisted in the Barbados Defence Force, passed commando training at Lympston, served in the Royal Barbados Police, and in 2005 applied to join the Life Guards to serve in the Armoured Regiment. But as is the way, he was posted to Knightsbridge Barracks, not to work on the tank park, but with horses in stables. Later, he trained as a driver for Scimitar CVRT, deployed to Helmand Province in Afghanistan, where in January 2010, his vehicle was caught in an IED, which resulted in the loss of both his legs. Known as Black Ice, the title of his autobiography, co-written with Christopher Joel, Corrie is now a silver medalist at Parabobsleigh in the European Championship. Currently in Austria, he soon travels to Switzerland and Norway with ambitions to win gold medals for the Parabobsleigh World Cup, European Championship, and World Championships. Life, he says, has taught me that the only person stopping you from doing something is yourself. We began by discussing how the sports recovery team at Headley Court, the former Forces Rehabilitation Establishment, encouraged him to take up the bobsleigh in 2014. I hope you enjoy the programme.
My attraction to it was I essentially used sport as a whole to get through my kind of recovery. And they knew me as a person that would try pretty much any sport. But when they came to me to do bobsleigh, I said, well, you know, guys, I'm pretty banged up as it is already. So I don't want to, you know, smash myself up any more than I already am. And, you know, they kept coming back to me and saying, look, you've got amazing hand-eye coordination and stuff, so you should do something that you think you should really try. So I went along, I gave in the end and went along to Calgary in 2014, I believe, and yeah, tried it for the first time, and the coaches liked what they saw and encouraged me to continue doing it. It's a very surreal thing. For me, I've never really focused on the actual injury itself. I've always focused on just being the best version of myself, so to speak. Because, you know, in life you will get setbacks. You will have things and situations that will put you in bad places. And it's how you deal with those things that will define you as a person. And I never wanted my injuries or anything that's happened to me as a result of this to define me as a person. So I kind of tend to just use the sport as my crutch in the beginning, and, you know, just try and focus on what I actually have and what I actually can possibly achieve rather than what has happened or anything in the past.
It's fair to say that that you've achieved a great deal. I mean, you are presently, if I'm right in thinking, you are the European champion. Is that correct?
No, I'm silver. Silver medalist.
You're a silver medalist in the European Championship. You're going out now to Austria, to Switzerland, and to Norway. And your plan is perhaps you might outline us to us. What is the plan? What is your aim in this winter parabobsleigh season? What is your aim to come back with?
My aim is to win everything. That is the ideal situation, but the aim is to go there.
When you say that your aim is to win everything, what is everything?
Okay, so we got five more races to go in the World Cup. We got one of those races as the European qualifies as the European Championships, and then we go to Norway and we have a kind of a four-lauf race, which is kind of a similar race to what you would have in the Olympics. So it's a four-heat race. And essentially, it's the times collated over 2 days. 4 heats and 4 days. Four heats in 2 days. And essentially, I would love to do, I've never been world, like the four Lauf race champion, but I've been the World Cup champion. For me, the World Cup is where it's at, but my coaches don't want me to just focus on the World Cup. The World Cup for me is the bread and butter of every bobsleigh pilot, because simply because it shows consistency over 10 races overall, all over the world. And for me, that's where it's at. I love it. And from the first time I saw those trophies, you get some big crystal globes. And from the first time I saw those, I fell in love with it. And I was just like, I want one of them every year. So I've managed to kind of amass like five now.
Yeah.
Out of the 6 or 7 years that I've been competing, I've only not been in the top three twice. So, but I've never dropped out of the top five in the world. So that's where we want to stay. For me now, I'm realizing that the winning is great, but the relationships mean more. So I know this might sound bad, but it's not really to focus so much on the winning, but to focus on the living, if that makes sense. The fact that I am alive and I'm good, I'm healthy, and I'm able to do it. I don't have PTSD, I don't have any mental illness, I don't have any physical things holding me back except my legs, really.
Yeah.
And my aim is just to go out there and enjoy the fact that I'm able to compete with some wonderful people, to go to some beautiful places in the world. And hopefully being able to enjoy it will give me the results that I need.
See, are your family able to come with you and watch you achieve greatness?
No, they've never been able to come, but sometimes we have the streams and stuff, live streams and so on, and they will follow in that way. But they're used to seeing me do certain things now, and they don't really, it's just normal for them. So whereas others would think, oh, that's awesome or whatever, they'll be like, oh, daddy's just doing it again.
Daddy's just doing it again. I mean, daddy is actually a world-class athlete, which is something that perhaps when you joined the British Army in 2005, you never thought was going to be the situation, did you?
No, not at all.
So when you joined the army, you had already been with the Barbadian police and also with the Barbadian regiment. Why did you want to join the British Army?
When I was a kid, I joined cadets in Barbados, and I became an NCO, and we would read these drill pamphlets and we would read the field craft pamphlets. And they would have grenadiers, Coldstream, Scots Guards, all these different people. And you see these beautiful pictures of these guys holding pay sticks and looking so sharp in the uniform and whatnot. I was just like, I want to do that. But going even further back, I visited this country in 1985, I believe, with my sister. And my uncle took me to Buckingham Palace. And I saw, I believe it was the Grenadier Guards. I remember that left a lasting impression on me personally. It's something that rekindled once I saw the pamphlets and stuff as a cadet. But like most Caribbean kids, you grow up and you have these dreams and aspirations, but you don't really have anyone like pointing you in the direction how you can achieve them. And it's only like, you know, after the internet came along, that I was able to kind of research how to do it. You know, having joined the Barbados Defense Force and stuff, I wasn't really fulfilled in that way. They weren't going to Afghanistan or Iraq or anything. I wanted to experience everything that a soldier would experience. But my dad didn't want me to become a soldier. He wanted me to be a police officer, and that's how I ended up in the Royal Barbados Police Force. But while I was in the police force, I was always researching. And in 2003, 2004, I took some leave with a friend and decided we were going to go and have a go at the Royal Marines, PRMC. And we had a go and we passed. And unfortunately for me, my dad died maybe 2 weeks after I came back. Maybe 2 weeks after. So I felt guilty. And because of it, I kind of just went back, you know, kind of head down trying to be a police officer, because I felt that that's what he wanted me to do. And then, you know, I just thought, no, Corey, this is wrong. Like, you got your kids, you want to give them more. You're still relatively young. Why not go after what you want? But when I went back then for the Royal Marines, they said, oh, you have to go through the PRMC again. I was like, no chance, because that was a pretty hard experience. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't as fit as I was for that again. So I said, okay, so I went to see a guy who ended up to be a corporal of horse in the Household Cavalry. And he showed me these scimitars driving across the prairie in Canada. And I thought, oh my goodness, I want to do that. And he said, well, okay, well, you know, I'm a Jehovah's Witness and I don't believe in this, but I will support your ambition, your goal. And passed my army selection. I went into Purbrake in November.
You wanted to work with scimitar with the armored regiment, but you ended up being pushed to the mounted regiment. Is that correct?
I know. I thought someone was punishing me. But you know what? At the time, I kicked and screamed because I thought, oh no, this is not what I signed up for. I didn't want to do this. But it turned out to be one of the absolute best experiences in my life. Not just because of who I was training with, but because, you know, after you go through the training was difficult, but my car key ride, for instance, ended in Bodney Camp. My pass off was doing an outdoor jumps course and cross-country course, and you're doing all this flat work and stuff outside in this beautiful place, and you're riding along the beach and taking the horses into the sea, and it was just like, there are worse situations you could be in. You know, so
you had never ridden a horse before you were told you were going to Knightsbridge, had you?
No. And it turned out to be one of the best things. I mean, there is literally no feeling like riding out the ceremonial gate to escort Her Majesty. There's no more proud feeling that you can have than that. And for me, being the first guy from Barbados to do it, I thought, you know, I remember getting quite emotional on my first escort, because I thought to myself, my mother would be so proud. And the people who, you know, thought I would fail coming here or whatever the case might be. And I thought, you know, you've literally worked your ass off to get this. Sorry. you've worked so hard to get here. I know, here you are sat in on a horse guards parade in front of Her Majesty, and you know, there was just no better feeling. It is literally the best thing, one of the best things that's ever happened to me. But in my heart, I had come to join the armored regiment. And that's where my heart was. So every course they offered me, BTEC, whatever it was they offered me, I said, no, I want to go on D&M. I want to join the scimitar. I want to be a tank crewman. And that's, in the end, that's where we went.
So you got your coveralls on, you got into the sumps and the grease bits of a scimitar. When you took the vehicle out on, and you went out onto the ranges and put the vehicle through its paces, how did you find that?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. Like, I had a phenomenal driving instructor as well. And then I had two good guys that were training to go to D Squadron in the Household Cavalry. So we were very excited and we enjoyed our time there. And then the mechanical side of it, you learn from the smallest nut and bolt to the biggest thing. And you were expected on duty to maintain and keep that vehicle going. And when I went to Battis in 2008, I had my first experience in doing that. So that was, you know, I loved it. I loved it.
You went out to Helmand in 2009. And tell us about how it was when you were actually, therefore, on operations in Afghanistan.
So I deployed in October 2009 with C Squadron, the Household Cavalry. So we had a massive group. We also performed a lot of overwatch for, like, the replens from Bastion to the different parts of Northern Helmand. So that was fun. But for me, my real stuff started when I went back to to Bastion and collected the CVRTs, and we came up to Northern Helmand with the CVRTs. That's what I wanted to do. That for me, that was my dream. That was the dream. And we did a lot of stuff. We liberated a lot of villages from the tyranny of the Taliban. Gave people a good quality of life again. People, kids, farmers, you know, were able to go to school. They were able to come out of their houses and start functioning as normal families again. They had families that hadn't seen each other for years. So, you know, it was fantastic to see these things unravel in your eyes, in front of your eyes, because you get to these villages. I remember when the last village I went to, it was just a village just below PB Habib. And looking down on this village, I remember thinking, oh my God, like it is literally a desert town. It's there's nobody there except the people taking pot shots at us and whatnot. And within maybe 2-3 days, kids were on the streets. Wives were coming out, husbands were coming out and selling vegetables on the street again. Farmers were farming again. It was beautiful to see. And, you know, it's nice when people ask why we went to Afghanistan. That's why we went. We didn't go to hurt anyone or to do anything. We went to liberate people from tyranny. So for me, that blessed my heart in a sense, because it was great to see that we caused a positive change in these people's lives.
Being blunt, you lost both your legs in the cause of doing the great work that you say talk about. How do you feel about at the withdrawal from Afghanistan as a result of that?
To be completely honest, I don't think there's any one of us that's injured or hurt, that was severely hurt, had a life-changing injury, that isn't sad about it or regrets the fact that we were injured or had life-changing stuff happen. But I personally, I can't speak for anyone else, I don't regret going. As I said just now, you know, it's one of those situations where you had a positive impact on someone's life. And it's very easy to sit here in this country where we have, you know, we can drive anywhere we want, we can go anywhere we want. There's no one in our house telling us to load magazines and shoot at people. You know, it's very, very easy to sit here in safety and security and say, I would have done it this way, or I could have done this or that. But the reality of it is, we went there to give those people a better way of life. That I do not regret. I do regret losing my legs in a sense. I do regret, and I say in a sense there because I found out a lot more about myself strength-wise, physical and mental strength-wise, than having them. So for me, I don't have any regret in that regard. But I do regret the way that they did it. I do regret the way that they pulled out, because it was like ripping a plaster off. It hurt. And you've left a lot of people in the lurch there, in a situation that we could have drawn down the troops gradually, you know, over a longer period of time, and left the country in a more stable situation. At this present, we've got, I mean, I work for Wiltshire Police now as a PCSO, and, you know, I happen to be the point of contact for the people in Swindon Town, the Afghan people in Swindon Town. So at present, I'm trying to get clothing for the men. I've got a hotel here with a Holiday Inn Express that has 144 people in it. And I've got another one with Ibis that has 70 people in it. And, you know, I've encountered some of these men, and the stories that they will tell you, I mean, my God, like, we live an extremely privileged life in this country. We live in a privileged way in this country, and I don't think a lot of people understand that. So all that to say, no, I don't regret going. I regret my lost comrades. I regret the people that we lost. I regret the lot of us that were injured. Nobody deserves that. But also, I do believe that we needed to leave them to run their country, albeit we didn't do it the right way, in my eyes anyway. But in the end, it had to happen, and life goes on.
After you lost your legs in January 2010, having been through such trauma, life looked pretty grim. But you then said, don't exist, live. What was the turning point where you said, hang on, I can either be sitting in a wheelchair for the rest of my life, or I can get out there and do stuff?
I was still in Selly Oak at the time, and two things happened. I had my lowest moment, and then the moment that changed my mindset into, I have to keep fighting. So the lowest moment for me was, I went into the shower, just after I come out of ICU, and it was my first proper shower on my own, like without, you know, being wiped down by the nurses or whatever while you're in a coma. So I went into this, the nurse lady helped me into the shower, and you know, you turn the water on and you're like, oh my goodness, this is good, you know, warm water, and if you know all that. But then, you know, I see the blood kind of running off me and different things, running up my hair. And I look down at my legs and stuff, and I that was probably the lowest moment for me, because I completely broke, completely snapped, like sobbed like uncontrollably, to the point where the nurse was on the outside of the door and she was asking me, are you okay, are you okay? I couldn't answer her. So she came in and she saw what state I was in, and she wrapped her arms around me and stuff, and she kind of consoled me, helped me to finish showering and stuff. And you know, she's, you know, you're going to be all right, Corey. We're going to take care of you and you're going to be okay. As at a point as well, she's saying, you're seeing your kids, you're going to see your kids, you know, later today or whatever the case might be. So, you know, you want to be in good spirits for them and this and that, you know. And it was, you know, she was really encouraging. And so she helped me, you know, to kind of, you know, stop. And she cracked a few jokes and, you know, some banter. And then we laughed and we went back outside. But my daughters came to see me that evening, and the middle one, Jody, we have a unique relationship, I would say. She said to me, Daddy, you're going to be fine. You're going to get your legs. You're going to get some replacement legs, and you're going to be okay. You are going to walk. You're going to teach us to ride again, and you're going to be all right. I thought to myself at that point, you know, if they can see me as no different a man, then I have no reason not to fight for this, not to fight for life. And at the time there was another guy, there were two. There was one, Ken, a guy called Ken. He was an ATO and a Motec, and he was a triple amputee. And then there was Ricky Ferguson. He was in there as well. And he was quite badly damaged as well. He was a triple amputee, and he had facial injuries as well. And I saw these guys fighting as well, along in conjunction with that. And I thought to myself, you're a double amputee below. Like, as injuries go, that's a gift. So you don't have PTSD. You don't have any damage. I had damage to my hand, but it wasn't that bad. You're okay. So, after everyone left, I sent a message to the physio and tell her I'll be ready tomorrow. And for me, that was it. From that day, I never stopped. I never looked back. I started using fitness and sports and everything else I could get my hands on as a motivating tool.
To get that bobsleigh moving, you've got to have some pretty powerful legs on you. Tell us about the legs they give you.
For training, I must say that I only use legs to push the sled in training. In races, we have a propulsion device we call the cripple launcher. that device propels you off at you say the equivalent of a two-man sled and whatnot. Bearing in mind, it can't be too powerful because you're dealing with people with spinal injuries as well. Fortunately for me, I don't have any, but I have to remove my legs sort of to make me on par with a person who has a spinal injury. For me, pushing is just essentially we are trying to establish a push category for amputees and so on. And I was the first double amputee to do it, to run and jump in. So they were like, well, if he can do it, like we got to get this up and going. So from then on in Calgary, they would never push me off or hardly ever. They'd be like, you need to get your own legs and push and jump in for doing this. So, you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, every physio I've had, every kind of coach I've had has never treated me like a person with an injury. They've always been like, yeah, we're treating you like a normal person. You're going to do this. You're going to do this. You're going to do this. And I'm like, okay, try anything once, right? So I've never approached anything really with the mindset, I can't do it. Because I've had so many people along the way telling me, you can do this, you can do this, it's no problem, at least try it. So yeah, that's how I came about jumping in a bobsleigh with running blades on.
And you hurtled down the slide, I think, as you put it, 75 miles an hour. What's going through your mind as you're hurtling down that at such speed?
Truthfully, nothing. Like, you have to have a clarity of mind when you're doing that. You cannot be thinking about what's for dinner or how the kids are or nothing. You have to be thinking about the next 3, 4, 5 corners or how many of the corners you have in front of you. My coach has always encouraged me to break the track down into sections, into pieces. And so for me, when I'm in a sled, that's all I'm thinking about.
Is it a source of some frustration, some annoyance that you're not able to take part in the Winter Paralympics at Beijing?
That's a completely political subject. And it's a subject where I generally don't really have I don't really talk about that in that way, but because there are people fighting certain battles which the general public don't know about. So I don't, it's a subject I would like to stay away from, but it is hurtful in that we are as good as, in some cases, as the able-bodied pilots. And we have, in some cases, more pilots than in an able-bodied race. So it hurts in a sense because we've put a lot of time and effort into it. We've jumped through all the hoops that the IPC have asked us to do. And through little technicalities, people are holding us back. So yes, it is frustrating, but there's stuff in the works and I don't believe it's over yet. It's not over yet. I think you will see us within the next 4 years.
I'm sure that we will yet see you as a Paralympian when you come back, hopefully with all three gold medals for the World Cup, the European Championship and the World Championship. You start another great achievement in life, which is police training with Wiltshire Police Force. What are your hopes and ambitions for being serving with Wiltshire Police?
Well, I want to be a detective. I want to solve stuff. But I also have a unfinished business with canine, but as a canine dog handler as well. I think I'm going to be the first double amputee to go through the process, both as a PCSO, which is just a community support officer, which at present I'm doing. And essentially what we do is just basically, the only powers we don't have are powers of arrest. So it's, you know, our job is non-confrontational. We're meant to be going out there and just interacting with the public and doing certain things. Low-level enforced credit. Law enforcement. So it's good, and I do get to do most of the things that a normal police officer would do, but I want to challenge myself to do the top job, to do the real job, because I think I can do it, because I believe, you know, life has taught me that the only person stopping you from doing something is yourself. So I am looking forward to doing some wonderful things with Wiltshire Police. I honest to God, believe, I don't believe that anyone's supported me as much as they have. I've had a lot of people support me, but they have backed me to the hilt. Like, they give me the time to go and do bobsleigh. My sergeants are super supportive, and they actually genuinely care for my well-being. My team as well. Those people are so supportive of everything that I do. So I couldn't have chosen a better organization or a better team or a better place to work. And I think that speaks volumes for where the public are going, as far as the general public are going, as far as support for veterans is concerned. The other part of this for me is that this is my way to say thank you for all those public, all those members of the public who have pumped money into Heli Corps, who pumped money into us veterans, helping us to get back on our feet, helping us to get better. Because a lot of the time, those people will see us or hear that we've been injured, or another person's been injured today, or another person's died today. But they never actually see what we actually go on to become or hear how our lives turn out. And I believe this is my way of saying thank you to them for getting me back on my feet and paying them back for all the money that they've invested in me personally. I'm now back on the streets doing my job for them, looking out for them and taking care of them again. So I'm proud of it. And it's, I, you know, my life is a life of service. I've established that, and I have no regrets for it.
Corey Mapp, Black Ice, you are an example to us all. We wish you all the very best of luck in coming back with gold three times over. Thanks for being my guest on General Talk.
Thank you for having me, sir.
And my thanks to Corey Mapp for being my guest. Black Ice, memoir of a soldier, double amputee, and world champion, Corey Mapp's autobiography, is published by Nine Elms, price £15. From me, Harry Bucknell, thank you for listening. Until next time, keep smiling through, and farewell. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldier Charity.